Welcome to AVXL Episode 5, recorded on January 21st, 2016. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Herron.
And we love home theater, home entertainment, good music, amazing speakers, headphones, and earbuds that make you go, mmm. Or just sit there quietly and enjoy the music if you prefer. Hey, everybody. We are so thrilled to be here, and we're excited that you all are supporting us on patreon.com/AVXL. We've reached our second milestone, which means Robert and I have to get busy and start making some videos. We thank you for that. And yes, for those of you who have asked, we are working on some alternative ways of contributing to the show besides Patreon. And also, look, if you don't have money to donate, we understand that. Do us a favor, like us, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook, give us the big likes. And if you have time to go into iTunes or whatever your podcaster of choice is, please, please take a minute to review us and preferably say nice things and tell all your friends about us, especially if you're a home theater or audio manufacturer and you'd like us to know more about your products, give us a holler. ask@avxl.com is the way to reach us. And man, it's interesting. Should we talk about some of your excitement with OLED calibration, or should we start with the news that Foxconn, who pretty much makes all of the iPhones, is trying to buy Sharp, which I think has Japan freaking out, because of course Sharp has a tremendous amount of intellectual property tied up in screen manufacturing or flat panel manufacturing. And Foxconn's offered like over $5 billion, the Wall Street Journal says, to take over Sharp.
That is interesting. Well, Hisense apparently has the Sharp name for TVs.
The brand.
The brand name for 5 years.
And
so,
to Hisense's credit, they're doing a lot better with the HD TVs than I've seen, or the TVs, or the 4K TVs, or the UHD TVs I've seen. I'm just going to call them TVs for the rest of the episode. Than I've seen with some of the other revived brand names over the past few years. I swear I saw a Polaroid-branded HD TV a few years ago, which made me laugh.
I'm looking forward to seeing Hisense take over for the Sharp name and bring their technology to it. That, I think, is a great thing. The adventures in calibrating OLED, though, that was interesting this week, I have to admit. I had a client earlier this week who had the 55-inch EF9500 mm-hmm. OLED from LG, of course. The flat screen 4K OLED a lot of people were waiting for. Had a chance to get that set up and fine-tuned it to perfection, and it looked really good. That TV in particular has both the 2-point and a 20-point white balance setup. And I have to say, I kind of just did the 20-point because it was there. But that is a long grind to get through that.
So you said that calibrating an OLED was distinctively different from calibrating a traditional or a standard sort of LCD or plasma TV.
It'll be not too much. It's pretty much the same process, but going forward with high dynamic range, to properly calibrate that on a mm-hmm. TV that fully supports the new standards, be it HDR10 or Dolby Vision, or that requires a different methodology compared to the way we've been calibrating TVs to this point. Mm-hmm. However, for this setup, this is pretty much a standard 4K TV that is HDR ready, right. And I was doing it to support specifically the current color and detail standards used in broadcast and Blu-ray as they exist right now, which is effectively Rec. 709, they call it, right. For a lot of it. And the setup overall went great. Doing the 20-point setup was just tedious. I compare that experience to something like, say, Panasonic's last plasmas that you could control through IP. Basically, if you're both on the same network with the right software, you can have the software directly control the TV settings. That made going through a 10 or 20-point setup or color setup, it made it just that much easier. And the fact that you're just constantly in the menus to use this 20-point feature of the LG TV, while I'm glad it's there, it's just a lot of work for, you know, I guess it's worth it in the end. The one thing, though, that it brought up with some other folks I've talked to was the difference in burn-in, or the way image retention works.
Is it more likely on OLED? Is burn-in back, baby?
Burn-in, you can burn in any display. Burn-in, for those who don't know exactly what I'm talking about, it's uneven pixel wear.
Right.
That's really what it comes down to. Back in the day, it was with phosphor-based displays where...
You used to see video games where, like, the high score area or the title that would be repeated over and over again for hours, and then the scene would change, and you'd see basically burned out dark spots where the phosphors had been worn out. And then that became a huge issue. We had some viewers who ran into back in the early days of DLTV and HD Nation, where they had particular channels that were playing, you know, where they left on, whether it was ESPN or the Weather Channel or whatever was on, you know, 80% of the waking hour of the television, had the same bug in the corner, and the bug would become burned in. And there, that led to a whole series of actions on the part of HDTV manufacturers to figure out ways to sort of revive the dead spots in the corner of the monitor, but also led to a lot of cable channels changing the nature of their bugs or making their bugs move or just not do the same collection of pixels in the same spot for the entire length of the broadcasting day.
The better broadcasters actually took the cue from angry plasma owners, which this affected more so than any other display type at the time. And they did much better with their graphics and stuff. And as OLED compares to LCD or plasma, it is far closer to an LCD in terms of its robustness, in terms of minimizing uneven pixel wear. I have a plasma screen, a very nice one, in storage right now that it has a score ticker kind of burned in slightly on it. And I really need to run some just general video on that to help even that out a little bit. In the case of this OLED, though, I found that whenever my test patterns were on the screen or anything like that, and I changed to another test pattern, you would see an after image of that test pattern still left on the screen, particularly if I switch quickly over to a full white frame or something like that to look at. There was some after image, and this was very different from what you would call burn in. I also find in the stores, when I look at OLED screens at the favorite retailers, you will see, especially if they're showing the same loop or if this loop has really hard-edged graphics and things like that in it, you will see like an after image appear that could be easily mistaken for burn-in. However, I have not actually seen an OLED with distinct uneven pixel wear yet. And one of the cool things about, or the unique things, I should say, about LG's OLED technology is that the OLED material, the material that actually glows, the organic light-emitting diode, it is white, and it is color-filtered, like an LCD.
Really?
So there isn't individual red, blue, and green OLED materials like other OLED manufacturers have tried, like Samsung in particular and Sony, where the big issue there was having, with the three independent OLED colors, was having uneven wear between the three chemistries. In the case of Sony's original, we're talking a few years ago, their 11-inch OLED panel, blue would wear faster than the other colors. So slowly the TV would become more yellowish over time, the display and how it looked. In the case of LG's OLED, though, I am finding that white material is fairly robust, and I have not seen any distinct burn-in yet. I'm not saying it's impossible. Any flat panel display can be burned in. I've seen LCDs with horrible burn-in that were left, you know, displaying relatively static graphics, often very hard white edges and things like that, that are just driving the panel as hard as can be without a lot of motion, and that will cause burn-in, and that's something you do want to avoid on most displays. Now, this is like something you would have to work at for days and on end. This is not something that's going to happen in 5 minutes or even an hour. You can be pretty confident with any display type that, you know, you don't want hard-edged graphics on a plasma screen, generally speaking. You want to stick to motion video, which is pretty easy to do. But for modern LCDs and OLEDs, I'm finding you can have a static image on there for a while, but it's... Even with LCDs, you don't want to leave it on there for days on end if you're trying to think of, like, I'm thinking of, like, signage applications, or the worst case of OLED or of LCD burn-in I've ever seen was in a casino in Las Vegas. I want to say it was the Wynn. They had all these beautiful sharp panels. I remember that first year, everything looked great, but then they had all these static, like, Keno signs and things like that. And it came back a year or two later, and they were all burned in. They had switched over then to motion graphics and things like that to help compensate for it. But wow, there's a good number of panels within that hotel that were all similarly affected. Not good, not good. But anyway, I got to say, calibrating LG's OLEDs, the only issue I really ran into was just the tediousness of doing a full 20-point setup for that white balance compared to most TVs where you have just 10. And ideally, I had really good results just using the 2-point controls as well. So I think I'm going to charge a little bit more doing 20-point grayscale setups going into the future.
Ouch.
And I wish they would open up the interface, too, so you could do it with IP control in a, you know, like a web browser interface, too. But that's custom installer stuff. More so.
Serious.
Than, Yeah, but it sure would be handy. Instead of using a motion-controlled remote and just digging through literally 20 points
Anyway. Oh, my goodness. I've been playing around with the $9 chip PC, much to my emotional detriment. We'll talk about that another time.
Okay.
Well, the first, it was a Kickstarter project. The first round of them were not, they had a software glitch, but getting that sorted. But it's an amazing, it's kind of like a Raspberry Pi, which means it has a tremendous potential for, say, running Kodi or Plex on Linux as a home theater box. A relative, you know, it's $9, an incredibly inexpensive home theater box. What's interesting about it is, unlike the Raspberry Pi, it does not have an Ethernet jack built on board, but it does have Wi-Fi built in. It stores its memory. You don't need a micro SD card for memory storage, or basically to load the operating system. But it has Bluetooth and Wi-Fi built in for $9, which is really compelling. And it should, as far as 1080p is concerned, it's got the graphics oomph on board to do that. But I was joking because I forgot how much I hate composite video, which, if it's been a while since you've played around with standard definition televisions, or if you're of an age where you've not actually seen the little RCA jack with the yellow band around it, that is composite or old school video. We could go more old school than that, but I don't want to really get into channel converters and other horrors of my youth. But
that's the least common denominator for video nowadays, right? Is that yellow jack.
I'd say the least common denominator for video now is HDMI, based on the fact that I had to come in right into here to the Hack 5 warehouse to find a television with an AVR jack on it, or an old school composite AVR jack on it. But that led to MQ Nerd tweeting, at Patrick Norton, composite cables suck for colorblind people. The inputs are always in dark places facing walls, so there is never enough light. And the truth is it doesn't matter if it's a composite cable or not. I've decided that luxury televisions should have LED lights over the ports. That said, a headlamp is a must-have in your toolkit. I tweeted back to at MQ Nerd. And seriously, if you spend a lot of time fixing people's televisions or adjusting their settings or cabling stuff up, a headlamp is incredibly useful.
Oh yeah,
it points light where your face points, and you don't have to use your hand. And as stupid as that sounds, I still see people trying to juggle a flashlight and wrestle an HDMI connection while like holding the television away from the wall with their shoulder, which is just not the way to do it.
In my gear kit, I actually do keep a couple of LED flashlights just for the room is usually dark. I don't feel like going over to turn the lights on and off every time I want to walk up to the meter and check it or check some setup thing. I'll just kick on the flashlight really quick to take a look at what I need to do and get the room back into its darkness where I need it to be for the setup anyway. So,
oh my goodness.
That's a good point, though. Yeah. I don't think you're going to convince any manufacturer to put lights on the back of the TV, except for maybe Philips and their Ambilight system, I'm thinking. if they continue to do that. Actually, Philips has some new stuff coming out this year. I really have done nothing but poo-poo that company for the last 5 years or so, because honestly, their TVs were garbage. So the things they've been showing...
They've been doing some great headphones.
The Philips TV brand, though, has really needed some help. And the last couple of years, I see them doing very interesting things. And I'm really curious to see if they can start selling TVs in this country again. I know they're popular in Europe, but I want to really I really hope they come back. I think as long as there's more competition and more selection, we end up with better products no matter how it goes. So seeing brands like Sharp and TCL and Hisense and those guys go up against some of the biggest brands out there, with apparently quality products for this year, I think this is just going to be a fantastic year for display systems overall. But
judging from what we saw at CES, there's just going to be a lot of very, very pretty glass out there.
Nice.
It's not going to pull me away from my projector lifestyle, but it's tempting.
Everyone needs a projector lifestyle.
Eric Ravenscraft over at Lifehackers, good article. Netflix is about to raise prices for grandfathered users as expected. I'm having consonant issues today. He writes, if you've been with Netflix since 2014 or earlier, you're probably paying around $7.99 a month, even though new users pay $9.99. This year, that ride is coming to a close for many users, basically because Netflix wants to make more money. And as Eric points out, Netflix, when they announced the price hike way back in May of 2014, they said you were going to get grandfathered in for 2 years, and boom, you saved about $48 and... And now you're going to get a brief increase. I have no issue with this, in part because I am still obsessed with Jennifer Jones, and which is just a fantastic series.
It's a service I use a lot, yeah, as a cord cutter, and even if I wasn't, it's just it's the first place I'll turn to because, yeah, I'm paying for it, but man, a good selection, good quality. They're focused on all the things I like in terms of, you know, their encoding schemes to the audio support, right, to closed captioning. It's a well-rounded service, and their in-house content is fantastic. I am impressed that they have become such a powerhouse of content creation now.
I've been laughing because at this point we get Amazon Prime, Amazon Instant Video because we have Amazon Prime, Netflix. I started subscribing to Showtime out of curiosity and then discovered Penny Dreadful. We do HBO Now, mostly for, started with Game of Thrones, but we decided to keep it for some of the other stuff we found. So at that point, we're looking about, you know, depending on how you want to quantify the Amazon Prime cost, because I would have Amazon Prime even if I didn't get Amazon Instant Video, but I think we're looking at $40 on top of the cable bill per month right now. I'm going to have to do the math on that. I may not be as saving as much as I used to. Plus, we still own a bunch of stuff on iTunes, because when we started doing a lot of the purchasing of content, iTunes was one of the only games in town. But yeah,
I really, the $2 price increase for Netflix really doesn't bug me too much either. Yeah. For how much I use it, and for within households, you can have multiple, right, accounts to keep everyone happy in terms of, well, their favorites lists and things like that.
There's also been their that cues. Whole, I mean, the Netflix is paying a lot of money in different places to get their content carried, which sucks, and I think is fundamentally a violation of net neutrality, such as it may or may not end up existing in the future. But I think it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out and what happens with video traffic on the internet. I'm not feeling politically savvy enough to have an intelligent conversation about this right now, but it's going to be really interesting as we have more and more and more massive media companies pull their content out of places like Amazon Prime, which is difficult for them because Amazon is obviously such a tremendous place to sell, say, Blu-ray collections of your series. But it's going to be interesting to watch as more and more primary content, you know, creators or studios or networks start to create their own video, online video streaming services. It's going to be really interesting to see how that impacts, you know, carriage and whether or not cable companies finally openly go to war with anybody that provides video content online, which you could argue Comcast has already done by creating a secondary interior tier that's kind of privileged for their own content. But I don't want to get too cranky about that.
It is an easy thing to get cranky about. And I'm glad there is someone as big as Netflix to determine what these new boundaries are in terms
of... Well, they're getting spanked is what they're getting, and they're ending up having to pay for bandwidth that exists. But I'm going to start looking like a tree hugger and a communist and someone who doesn't understand. I don't know. It's an interesting situation that does not lend itself to metaphors. And, you know, Netflix is also in the interesting position of consuming just about more bandwidth than anybody on the planet right now.
Yep. Well, Google Fiber may save us all one day. So,
Google Fiber for everyone.
You know, it's bad as the providers are. Oh, yes, we could totally get down this rabbit hole. But it is also the network providers and how specifically here in the United States, it's a bit ridiculous what we pay for a given speed. And... it does not make it easier for people to unlimited incomes to enjoy it, nor right. does it really open up the possibility that somebody could start a brand new Netflix from scratch without encountering immediate hurdles in terms of how that content is going to get pushed adequately to your subscribers. And is it simply now that because Netflix was there first, you know, and they have the money to deal with it, that's the only way to get it done nowadays? Yeah. I'm gonna keep my EFF subscription donations yearly going just to make sure that they're on top of it and anyone else who's supporting equal data rights in terms of transit across the great inner tube.
Oh my goodness. On a more cheerful note, 2016 TVs are starting to arrive. I mean, it's traditional for we see a bunch of televisions at CES and they start trickling out, you know, January. Usually they start to seriously arrive in February, and some won't show up until this summer, like June-ish.
We were still seeing 2015 announced TVs not appearing until almost toward the end of the year, right. Literally. So Yeah. The first one I'm noticing right out the gate, and that really has my attention in the premium space, is Hisense's H10 series. Mm-hmm. This is using their Ultra LED technology 2.0. But this TV specifically has the full array local dimming, wide color gamut support. Mm-hmm. It is something I want to pit directly against Samsung's JS9500, their flagship currently, the 2015 right. flagship. $1,200 less, and that's street pricing. And very likely the H10 series from Hisense might even come in at a lower price point than the 2800 that right. it's going to list for initially. However, that's coming next month, February. And I really am going to beg them for a review unit and get that in, because if it lives up to the hype, that's serious savings over with solid LCD panel mm-hmm. technology. And I just, that just makes me more pleased than anything in terms of having a super bright panel, the full array local dimming, that effectively a grid of LEDs illuminating the display that can be individually controlled to really give you that contrasted picture quality, and things like wide color gamut support for, you know, Dolby's HDR standard or even HDR10, whatever, you know, for those upcoming formats. And those are already being distributed through sources like Amazon. With your Prime account, you have access to their handful of shows now that offer HDR support through an app in your TV.
So now all I got to do is figure out how I'm going to pay for a 4K projector. For, you know, with 1080p with a projector, it was I got to throw on one of my wife's favorite like Sense and Sensibility or a BBC, you know, Blu-ray of a classic Jane Austen miniseries. And that was the moment I sold her completely on the projector, because there was all of this detail. It was 1080p. It was a beautifully, beautifully mastered Telecine and master of the original content. So it looked better than she'd ever seen it. She's looking at like the embroidery patterns, like pausing the video to look at the embroidery patterns. I don't know if there's anything I can swing. I don't know if there's anything content-wise in 4K that I can actually pull that off with my wife, one. And two, 4K projectors are still a little pricey.
They are. And this year, though, I'm looking forward to checking out Optoma's. Basically, their RGB LED 4K projector, single chip, new light engine from Texas Instruments for that DLP setup. However, they have an RGB LED projector out now, and it's priced pretty well. But if this new home theater projector can be well under $5,000, I think they have a tremendous winner on their hands, especially when you get into good optics right. with things like lens shift and other just quality features you almost have to have on a projector nowadays to get good image quality where you need it and still provide some flexibility for the setup in terms of where the projector is placed in the room
right.
and being able to move that image around without distorting or affecting its just overall detail. And that I'm really looking forward to. And I'll get an update from them about when that one's coming up. So
it reminds me of a question. We got email question from Rob W, who says, I recently picked up a projector for my entry-level basement theater. The projector is the Epson 8350. I picked this projector for its brightness, but most importantly, its throw distance and lens shift, which gives me a ton of placement flexibility. Let's not forget the killer Fuji lens. To this issue, I've had the projector running for about 1,000 hours. I've cleaned and replaced the filter about every 200 hours, but I still have dust blobs. The blobs are light green on dark scenes. Is this a problem, or is this just part of projector ownership? Thanks again. Keep up the good work. Rob W. So I will say on the Optoma I have, which is is using DLP technology, I have almost never seen dust blobs, which is amazing because I have a 3-year-old, an 8-year-old, 2 cats, a dog. My wife keeps chickens in the backyard, and dust is kind of a way of life, or dander or whatever, you know, I dream of a dust free home. And either because of, I've been particularly, lucky or, who knows? I've never really had any of the blob issues that some people report. It is fairly common on the 8350 that Rob has. And there's a crazy AVS forum thread that's like 900,000 pages long, as they tend to get on AVS forum, which is one of the many, many reasons I love it. And they have a dust blob fix for it, which is basically, to summarize, we'll put a link to that page in the show notes, is, you know, taking like 12 screws off, opening up the case, finding the 3 LCDs, and spraying compressed air on all 3 LCDs. Warning, because I have been around when Robert Heron blew flammable compressed air through a warm projector, which will burst into flames. Which
yeah,
is...
those cans of quote unquote air, that's actually a very flammable gas they're shooting out. And be aware, you should never run that through a, never squirt that into a running projector with a hot lamp module.
Basically, if you decide to clean your projector, make sure it's been off for like an, also so you just don't burn the snot out of yourself on the lens or cause any of the lenses to crack or the bulb. But
the module in particular is the hot spot.
Absolutely. I mean, painful, like, you know, second, third degree. Well, second probably, but not third
degree. That's one major difference between the having a single chip DLP projector versus a three chip system. The decreased complexity of it. One, you don't, on a single chip system, you won't ever deal with convergence problems where getting all three color panels to align properly. The other is you end up with a more complicated, probably a cooling system as well, in terms of routing it through and making sure everything is being properly chilled. I'm not sure exactly how those dust blobs are forming. I look forward to checking out the thing you found.
It's in, well, essentially dust gets inside the case, right? They have a filter, but it's not a HEPA grade filter. So, you know, in theory, some fairly small dust mites can get through the filter. It's, you know, some people have it worse than others. Some people, you know, they clean it like once a year. Some people, you know, seem to have larger issues. It's not, by the way, just that particular Epson projector. You know, I found another article that talked about like how to remove dust blobs from Optoma HD70, 72.
Okay.
There's a good article. And of course, I lost the link to it. Actually, I guess it's the projector people, probably.
We'll dig that up. Show note it.
The projector people FAQ in their customer service section. You know, the first question under image problems, why do I see blue, green, or red smudges or blobs of my projected image? Answer, more than likely what you're seeing is dust on one of your LCD panels. Try pausing your image so that these abnormalities are clearly visible. I'm quoting, by the way, this is the projectorpeople.com FAQ. Then simply defocus your projector in both directions. You should see these blobs actually become a solid object, either in the form of a string of lint or a spot of dust. To avoid dust blobs from occurring, it's important to perform routine maintenance on your projector. Cleaning off the filter with a vacuum on a monthly basis will help reduce accumulation of dust buildup. Vacuuming the outside of the case is a really good idea. You know, making sure you actually filter the air in your house helps. Vacuuming your house. I mean, it basically comes down to things that reduce the amount of dust in your house are a huge deal.
Yeah, if you're in a dusty environment, it's going to require more maintenance than if you're not. Yeah. And likewise, with a three-chip system where you're dealing with three imagery objects, three chip panels, that just triples the amount of potential that dust can actually affect what you see compared to something like your single chip system. So, that's something else to keep in mind for sure. But this person was also doing everything else I would recommend in terms of replacing the filters regularly. When you're replacing that filter, you have to be especially careful that as soon as you're pulling that out, if it was especially crusty or something, that particles would get inside as soon as you remove that filter or you banged it in such a way that it did. But this person seemed to be doing everything right, but they still ended up with the problem. But apparently it is fixable. It is a DIY repair if you're careful. But do be careful and follow the directions very carefully. If you can find a video on someone actually working on it, I'll bet you there is one specific to just about every projector out there doing that kind of check and fix. So
it's funny, they sell what basically amount to a vacuum cleaner, something in between sort of a vacuum cleaner bag and a dryer sheet of these sacks for PCs that are in super dusty industrial environments. I don't think that would be a good idea to wrap around your projector because your projector requires a fairly significant airflow to keep everything cool, i.e. not melty inside. If you've never seen a projector that's melted, you do not understand why I do not want you to cover any of the air vents on the projector. But it can be tough. And part of it can also be, you know, maybe, you know, an extra, if you can figure out what the dust is, like, you know, an extra layer of paint in the area above the projector in case it turns out that every time one of your teenagers jumps in the kitchen, a little bit of something falls from the ceiling. Dusting the ceiling, which is so anal I can't even get into it, but something that may actually make a significant difference in your home. Oh my goodness. We got a question for Robert at Hades. Says, picture contrast is more important for picture quality than screen resolution. Is 55 inches too small? Which kind of, I think, begs the question, you know, what's more important for picture quality, resolution or contrast? And it's interesting because what a lot of people don't realize is that your eyeball did not evolve your eyeball and your entire, you know, sort of the image processing system in your brain isn't really about color. It's about detecting movement of animals trying to eat you at night. So when you start looking at us in the animal kingdom, you know, our smell sucks, our hearing's mediocre, our color recognition, you know, and our eyesight is okay, but we are really badass at cowering in fear and detecting motion in the distance.
This is very true.
At twilight.
Superior black and white resolution.
Which means we are really sensitive to contrast.
We are. And that is the number one aspect of good picture quality. It doesn't matter. Pixel count is way down the list. Number one will always be contrast. That ability to have really bright detail and really dark and convincing inky dark detail, ideally in the same scene. But that is what you want to look for if you're going for pure picture quality. I say get the biggest screen you can fit, mm-hmm. just so you have the most immersive viewing experience you right. can have. And then beyond that, I don't even look at 4K versus, you know, 1080p. At right. this point, if you're talking about any TV above 32 inches, it would be nice to have a 1080p minimum resolution.
Yeah. I mean, it's under 32 inches, you know. It's kind of funny. If you're putting televisions in a bar and nobody can get, you know, closer than 15 or 20 feet to the television, you know, yeah, you're not really going to notice a 60 or 85-inch 720 TV because you're so far away from it. You know, in the distances we're viewing at now, 1080p is, I think, really, really critical. And I don't think 55 inches is too small, but I think if you are coming from a smaller TV, you may wish you went bigger, because the experience, you know, people are still, even after closing in on a decade of HDTV purchases, still buying smaller than they need to. And I got to say, one, 1080p looks absolutely fantastic, you know, on a 100-inch screen on my wall.
Honestly, 6 foot wide is about where you need, as far as screen size goes, just the width.
Right.
Just to see all of the detail that's possible in 1080p. So mm-hmm. when you were talking about earlier how you're looking at some of your Blu-rays and stuff, and or even broadcast TV, and seeing right. new detail that you hadn't seen before, if you've never seen South Park on like a large projection screen, you'll realize that a lot of that isn't just solid color, but actually fine textured mm-hmm. Detail within that. That's animation, but you get into like full blown, not real, but actual movies and things like that.
Cinema. Documentaries.
Those kind of things.
Some of the crazy over the top nature stuff on Blu-ray there's an absolutely fascinating level of detail.
Small screen sizes make it hard to perceive all of that image detail, to really take it in and appreciate it. What do you call it? Scars and all, in the sense that when you start right. looking at broadcast content, you'll realize they do a lot of compression here or there, or it's all over the map. Like, I find the primetime TV shows the most moneyed things you can watch in late night or early primetime.
Right.
Those are shot beautifully at high bit rates on good quality cameras and things like that. But you'll look at other content throughout the day. It could be 720p. There's still a lot of that right. in use. It could just be highly compressed, where you have things like mosquito artifacts and little. Compression artifacts are the things I notice the most, mm-hmm. without a doubt. And that is where, you know, that's where a smaller screen actually helps in terms of hiding it. But if you want to see everything there is in terms of what that video signal is offering, just simply increasing the screen size is the first step. And then beyond that, yeah, resolution, yeah, the jump from 1080p to 4K is not nearly as noticeable as I find with an increase in contrast. Like, say, that 55-inch OLED mm-hmm. from LG, they have a 1080p model and they have a 4K model. I simply notice the contrast. Black is inky dark, colors pop, and that really is what your eye goes through first. I think the colorfulness, color accuracy, and then maybe at the top of the heap would be the contrast of the picture. Mm-hmm. And then fourth, it would be resolution. And that's just not my take. That's a lot of very, very learned video experts' take on it as well. And honestly, like we were talking about, what is our eye best at noticing? It's black and white detail. And having that contrast and the capability of it is key. And going forward for high dynamic range TVs, like mm-hmm. the super premium for last year, the super premium for this year, and going forward, hopefully we'll get that into a cheaper price point for all. But those TVs are superb, the ones that can do it. Like I mentioned, Samsung's JS9500.
Right.
When you look at high dynamic range content, like from Amazon or whoever, it really does captivate the eye more so than just a pure resolution standpoint.
It's funny, you know, because for so many generations, televisions in the United States, you know, a 37-inch television, you know, for decades was huge. It was massive. It was 40-inch televisions. That's ridiculous. You know, but it's when you start looking online and looking for sort of the optimal size of a television to kind of continue, you know, looking at the, you know, is 55 inches too small is one of the things at Hades asked Robert, you know, and the estimates vary. You know, Dolby, I want to say, says, oh, here it is, 2.5 times this, you know, an ideal viewing distance is about 2.5 times the screen measurement. So if you have a 60-inch screen, you should be about 12.5 feet away. And one of my favorite lines in home theater recommendations, quote, don't sit too close. If you can see the individual pixels, you're too close, which is
kind of true.
Humorous understatement for Dolby. You know, but when you look at some of the recommendations that are compiled, you know, for Toshiba, they say if, you know, and this is obviously an old recommendation because I haven't seen a Toshiba television in a long time. They were saying, you know, 5 to 8 feet for a 50-inch television or 5.5 to just under 9 feet for a 55-inch
television. That's closer to
THX's
recommendations for a more immersive viewing experience.
You know, Best Buy's recommendation is like 6 feet 8 inches to 12 feet 8 inches for a 55-inch television. 6 feet 9 inches to 11.5 feet, I think, is Crutchfield's recommendations. And yeah, THX is definitely, you know, they're saying a 6 to 9 foot recommended range. So their viewing distance, you know, is between 28 and 40 degrees. So if you sit yourself directly in front of the television and you have, you know, your child or friend bring their protractor over, because everybody has a friend with a protractor, and strap it to the top of your skull, you know, or get your navigational instruments or your compass out.
All right, I print one out.
Yeah.
A sheet of paper.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, like for old school MTSC television, standard def television, it was like a 10-degree viewing angle. You were like 12 feet away from that CRT, that 30-inch CRT. Most places today are looking at like 30 degrees. THX is like a 28 to 40 degree view angle. And that's part of what gives you this tremendous cinematic experience, right? Because movies aren't designed, you know, your head, it's okay for your head to move around to try to, you know, get all of the detail in a movie, but you don't want your head constantly swiveling to follow dialogue.
Totally.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. It shouldn't be a stressful.
Yeah.
Stressful viewing experience, period.
Air to the larger, you know, try to get the center of the screen at eye level, or at least, you know, eye level with the bottom of the display, if not the middle of the display. You know, in my room, the display is about 10 inches from the top, which is a little high, but it's also a 100-inch screen. So the bottom of the display comes down to just above eye level. So it ends up working. We slouch a little bit on the couch, but not a lot. But, you know, air to the larger size if you're looking at a television. You know, if you're like, oh, the 55 or the 60-inch version, if it's not a huge price penalty or you don't care, air to the larger television. I don't know anybody who's really regretted it, although what a friend of ours used to refer to as the spousal acceptance factor may vary a lot depending on where your television is located and how enthusiastic your life partner is viewing whatever it is they like to watch. So ladies, if he's saying get the smaller TV, put your foot down and get the TV you want.
Yep.
And put it wherever you want. So
this also assumes too that you're dealing with very good image quality, the best video sources available,
right,
in terms of that viewing distance. If you're dealing with, you know, lesser content, then you may want to sit back a little further anyway. And this is all pretty relative, but
yeah,
I'd much rather you have a larger display so you can see that content as is, to be able to see the problems within the source material, if any exist. So when you do come across those exceptionally good sources, mm-hmm, or the cameraman's doing very good work and focusing perfectly, you can appreciate it better. And that's the one thing that's harder to do on the smaller screens. The smaller screens generally make everything look okay.
Right.
It's hard to go wrong when the screen size.
For the kids watching the DVDs,
who cares?
Well,
no, not who cares.
On one hand, who cares? But you know, a favorite movie, you know, on a 1080p screen, a 65 inch or 100 inch 1080p screen, the DVD is not going to look good. The DVD is not going to look bad at 40 inches, but you're going to start noticing just a lot of ugliness at 50, 55 inches, and by 65 inches, you're just going to be wow. I wonder if there's anything on Netflix or Amazon Prime or anything else I can stream 1080p into my house.
That makes one last good point I'll throw in there, too, is the quality of any display to upconvert lower resolutions into the native resolution of the panel or the projector. That is going to become more and more critical as we move more TVs into 4K. The last reports I saw said within 2 more years, all TVs effectively 55 inches and larger are just going to be 4K resolution. Anything smaller than that, you might be able to find some 1080p sets. However, it's going to go to higher resolution. So are the video engines within these TVs doing exceptional work when it comes to rescaling low resolution, everything from standard def through 720p and 1080i? And what if the content has errors in it? Like I saw some standard def content that was being broadcast the other day, and it had scanline artifacts and other things in there that I would hope a good video processor would have been able to clean up a little bit better. So that's something I will be paying far more attention to this year, especially on 4K TVs, is that effective processing of standard def on up. And that could also include, you know, your classic gaming consoles that you've connected and what gets you the best experience that way. But for all content, scaling is critical to the overall experience. And is it simply just magnifying the errors, or can it actually help correct any of them? And when I say errors, I mean things specifically like compression artifacts or interlaced artifacts or just something that wasn't processed right or just contains cheapness.
Or wasn't transferred right.
Cheapness effects.
There's a lot of just unfortunate choices made in the compression of some television and movies, and a lot of stuff that was telecined not particularly without a lot of love or care.
Truly.
And then compressed with even less love or care.
Well, we'll have ultra high definition Blu-ray in another month and a half, to coming March 1st, apparently.
And suddenly my life had meaning again.
Well, we'll have another pristine video source to compare all of our other stuff to. So,
oh gosh.
Or a gold standard, so to speak.
I'm not ready for another gold standard.
I am. Bring it on.
What does TCL stand for?
Oh, yeah. You know, somebody threw that at me. It's like, what does that company name even mean? And I had no idea. So it's a 32-year-old company. At one time, it was China's largest phone manufacturer. They started doing their TVs in 1992, and the TCL part actually stands for Telecommunication Equipment Company Limited. So that is where TCL comes from. I think you leave out the E for equipment, so the TCL would be Telecommunication Company Limited.
That's my kind of corporate name.
Yeah.
We sell drugs. Car Makers Incorporated.
Very descriptive. TCL.
The cable company, which I actually think is a cable selling company.
LG now means life's good, but back in the day,
Lucky Gold Star.
Yeah, baby. My dad has like a microwave that's 30 plus years old. That's Lucky Gold Star. And that thing looks brand new. It freakishly well built back in the day. So,
oh my goodness.
Anyways.
So here's I'm going to solicit everybody to tweet at AVXL or at Robert Heron or at Patrick Norton, or to email ask@AVXL. What do you think about speaker cable? Because I was laughing because I've been pulling I'm pulling new speaker cable for the AVR for the home theater, and I bought banana plugs. I'm getting old school. I'm doing it right. I had some time.
Did you buy any particular brand of banana plug, or just?
I started with an old school search for best selling banana plugs on Amazon.com, because on one hand, like I've done a lot of stuff with Sewell and some other ones.
That's the brand I like a lot.
Yeah, Sewell Direct is the Ocelot banana plugs. I'll have to take a look to see which ones I ended up with, because I started getting a little too investigative.
They're beefy and they work well. They're built like little tanks, man.
Well, I didn't want to have to solder them. That was one of my
no.
You know, I could probably look at my ordering history and figure out which ones I bought.
I know which ones I have. I bought a set of, I think, a dozen or so, just so I had plenty of them. Actually, I have them on my website.
You know, this is one of those moments when having turned dual-factor authentication on for Amazon is not the most useful thing.
I don't use two-factor for anything. I'm one of those weirdos. I just use incredibly long passwords.
You also licked doorknobs in Las Vegas during CES.
I asked my doctor about that.
We're talking about that on Tech
Thing this week. I asked my doctor point blank. It's like, will a flu shot interrupt my own natural way of achieving a resistance to the craziness of the world? He's like, what? It's like, or will it just add to it? Because if so, then I'll do the flu shot in addition to just you know, I let the dogs. Oh, never mind. Soul Direct, their deadbolt banana plugs.
That's
the ones
I ended up with, actually.
They are awesome. Yeah, they're well built.
They're crazy. Yeah, they're basically, it's instead of having a tip that's inserted into the screw mount for the base, it's all one solid piece of metal. So, you know, you can't torque it out. They've got a seal, a little rubber seal to help keep it from working loose. They're a little bit longer than the average ones. Yeah, and they weren't bad. It was like 12 pairs of them for $28.
And for AVRs that have binding posts on the back.
Yeah.
The trick there is you just simply, without any wire in it, you just screw them all the way down, and then the banana plug literally plugs right into the back, yep, into that center part. So it is such a nice way
to... You have to have some depth in where you're using it.
True. You can't have it jammed right up against the wall necessarily, yeah, but it is such an easy way to connect and disconnect speaker wire from an AVR. The way to do it.
And you might argue, well, I'm only going to connect them once.
Yeah.
Which... is, you know, and you may only connect them once, which is awesome. I hope to not disconnect these speaker cables for a very, very long time. But mostly it was because, you know, copper does not do well with being exposed to air. It's not as bad as it was, you know, when I lived down by the beach, when I lived in San Francisco, just it was where copper went to die if it was exposed. And I just didn't feel like having to tin the ends of all my copper wires and, you know, spending like a couple hours with the soldering iron. And I want something a little more robust. And if I start swapping out AVRs for testing or speakers for testing, I wanted it to be as simple and painless as possible. But mostly, though, even if you don't think you need it, it's not a bad idea. Just so you don't end up having to replace the cables or having to cut the cables and trim them and cut them off. Or deal with any kind of corrosion. The worst is when you see corrosion between a cable and a speaker, which is, you know,
makes me sad.
Yeah, it's repairable, but it's just it's nice to avoid that. But it's been interesting to look at some of the recommendations where some people are saying, oh, you know, if you've got a 50-foot run, you should go for at least 10 gauge wiring.
Damn, that's unwieldy.
Yeah, that's an expensive pile of copper to pull through your walls. You know,
I've used 14 gauge AWG.
Yeah.
In wall rated, mono prices. Which is,
they have
by
a great
the way,
price for it.
That and it's got the nicest, softest exterior sheath, mm-hmm, that can be stripped away, and it's got the foot markers, yeah, and everything on there. So if you're cutting length, but I've used that out to, I want to say 60 plus feet.
Yeah.
And
and 14 should be good for most human beings with an 8 ohm load.
It depends easily what load you're going to run through, yeah, stuff. And that's where you want to be, where you may need a thicker run. But if you're talking, you know, maybe runs out to 100 feet or more, you go down to like 12 gauge.
Right.
But otherwise, I find 14's like that nice happy balance for me between being reasonable to work with and being able to plug it into even the smallest speaker post bindings that I've dealt with,
mm-hmm,
yet still beefy enough and right, easy enough to work with.
12 gauge is pretty much overkill for most home theater applications. And I know there are some of you out there that have like $25,000, you know, $50,000 speaker systems. And I know you're out there because I get you talk to me. We have conversations. But, you know, who are saying like, who are basically using the kind of stuff that would be used, you know, to run, the wiring for a locomotive between the diesel generator and the motors, like big mat, you know, people spend thousands of dollars on interconnects and speaker cables. Generally speaking, this is overkill and unnecessary from an engineering standpoint.
Oh, here's something I found a while back, and I've kind of lived by this, but 14 gauge is considered ample for critical listening with, yeah, an 8 ohm load at 35 feet,
right,
and a 4 ohm load at 18 feet.
Yeah.
And if you want something beefier than that and you want to spend some money, I would turn to like the Blue Jean Cable folks, right, for doing custom length cool cables.
Or to, you know, 12, I mean, 12 gauge, if you're feeling kind of audiophile-y or if you're feeling like, oh, who knows what speakers will do in the future, I mean, run, yeah, 12 gauge. But, you know, the difference between, you know, it's funny, I'm looking at Monoprice and they've got two conductor speaker wire, you know, 250-foot spool, which is not a lot depending on the size of your listening room and what if you're running it through the walls. You know, they're CL2 rated, which is
pure copper.
Yeah. That's $83 for a 250-foot spool versus, you know, the 14 gauge wire was here just a second ago.
And that particular Monoprice cable, too, it's just got a very pliable white PVC jacket that it's just a breeze to work with. Oh, the conductors, the red and black, clearly labeled. Everything's just It just nice. Works.
Oh, by the way, spend $20 for a Brother labeler and label all of your cable as you're pulling it through the house.
Yeah.
As stupid as that sounds, that $20 labeler will save you more emotional trauma later on, or whoever moves into the house after you. But yeah, it's a 250-foot spool of 14-gauge wire is $57, and a 250-foot spool of 12-gauge wire, you're looking at $83. So, you know, on one hand, it's a pretty huge percentage increase, but compared to probably on what you spend in your AVR and your speakers and your Blu-ray player and your media collection, it's not a lot of money. I'll have to look. I don't know whether I got 14 or 12 gauge cable.
And I mean, then again, too, if you really step up into some of the super premium AV receivers or amplifiers and speakers, they're running XLR type connectors as well. So that those are probably my favorites. I mean, that's just such a, it's probably, you know, it's an overkill connection, but once you get into the higher end, the lower ohm amplification setups, a lot of them are running that XLR type connector, and that connector alone isn't cheap. So you're probably looking at you, and you can make your own, of course.
By the time I get to running like, you know, 4 ohm speakers over XLR cables, it's probably a sign that A, I have more money than I should be allowed, knowing me, and B, that my home theater habit has gotten completely unhinged. But if you are dealing with XLR issues, or if you are designing that $1 million home theater down in SoCal, living the life you've poured the X. I mean, don't get me wrong. I would. Why did you sell your home in Northern California, move to Idaho, so I could build a home theater barn? Well, so I could. Well, you know,
that may happen.
Stranger thing.
That may be the end plan.
Goodness. That would be, you know, that would be tempting. You know, just have that 20 by 20 foot, 20 by 30 foot outbuilding. If I can insulate it and not freeze in the winter.
Oh, yeah.
Go out and watch movies without waking up the entire family or wearing headphones. Not that wearing headphones is bad as often as I do.
The home theater barn.
Oh, my goodness.
I like that.
Dude, what are you watching this week?
Well, I just have to give a shout out to YouTube. What just a pile of stuff. Of covering all categories, and my favorite part is if you have the app running on a device connected to your TV or built in as an app on your TV, you can cast from your PC or your mobile device right to that player, as long as they're both on the same local network. So like my workstation, my phone, when we're all at home, I can tell it to say, hey, you know what, play this video or whatever on the TV in the living room or in the bedroom, and it just shows up as a device I can cast to. And the beauty there is I can also queue up videos. And right now I'm watching a dude named Jamie Mansell. He is a maker dude who used to be known for his crazy oversized robotics. But for the last couple of years, it's really his adventure moving him and his family off the grid and into an island in Panama. And this is the guy who would much rather fix or make something than go out and buy it. And
cool.
And there's a bit of like life lessons and stuff. And he was struggling recently with the cost of having internet in the middle of nowhere and things like that. And he actually created a Patreon account, which people just jumped on and supported him graciously. And he's going to be doing this for a while. But if you just want to watch a really positive kind of life story and just somebody who knows quite a bit about working with their hands and building cool stuff, in particular, I'm a fan of his solar powered boats. And his amazing work with stuff like marine grade plywood and fiberglass and just
it's amazing the boats you can make out of plywood.
I'm telling you, and his ability to create a model and work on that model, hammer it out, and then build the scale it up. It is step by step. Everything he builds teaches him something about the next thing he'll build. And terrific, Jamie Mansell, Mantzel. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And also, too, I got on somebody's butt recently about how they had an ad pop up on YouTube while they were watching something with their kid, and I didn't realize that this person was referring to just one of the pop-up ads that you don't have a lot of control over. So I went and took a look at the controls available for controlling your ad delivery system from Google, and it's not very granular. There are certain generic categories and things like that,
well,
but you can't be specific.
You can suggest categories. It's funny, we were talking about this on Tech Thing a couple weeks ago. As a content creator, you can shut down certain categories of ads. As a content subscriber, you can make suggestions as to categories where you would like to, or categories, you know, send me advertising stuff for this. But you know, the only real control you have over it is if you're in the United States to subscribe to YouTube Red for $9 a month and make all of the ads go away.
There you go. And so I found YouTube Kids was one option. That's a separate app that you can download and just have an experience for, arguably just for kids. And it really helps you fine tune what it is that's seen there. I've never personally used it with any young people, so I don't know if there's little gotchas involved there, but it's something a little less wild and crazy than compared to the raw YouTube experience. I also kind of did a mea culpa too, because I really got on this person's butt for like, so you're sitting there with your tablet watching YouTube with your account and you get all wigged out about some ad that appeared. And it's like, well, I didn't click on it. It was one of those interstitials that kind of pop up. So then I'm like, okay. So
well, YouTube's gotten pretty aggressive with the ads also, because they are trying to, you know, I understand why people run ad blockers, but as somebody whose, you know, family has been fed based on advertising revenue, I would prefer that you did not block ads, right? But that's a whole battle of the internet that we could go down quite a rabbit hole on. But yeah, it's kids.youtube.com, by the way, is the URL for that.
Check it out.
They have a Google Play and an Apple app for that. I will check that out, because it was frustrating. You know, the kids app on Netflix was really frustrating, because what I want as a parent is to, you know, pre-screen stuff. Like, one, I generally, you know, I don't let my kids, you know, I don't let my kids near the internet unless I'm in the room with them, just because.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that's going to work when they get into their teen years.
Oh, good luck.
Yeah. It'll probably be injected into their
They'll have you on the separate network, and they will be controlling the
I'm pretty sure I can stay ahead of them on networking technology.
I hope so.
When they have money
for you.
And are buying their own phones is when it's all going to break loose. But the what was frustrating about the Netflix kids experience is because it became this giant advertising area for characters, you know, and in some cases, you know, there's like certain, you know, like, you know, my child would see something over at a friend's house, or would see something, you know, in a toy store, and then would want to investigate it because they saw the you know, because YouTube Kids is like, oh, they see the character they want and they click on it, and that, you know, pops up. And Wild Kratts is one thing, but, you know, a particular, you know, caffeinated cartoon that shall remain nameless, that, you know, would basically drive my kids into little headbanging, thrashing frenzies that looked like it belonged at CBGB's on a bad Friday night, is not something I really want on rotation. But whenever they went into YouTube Kids, they would see that character, and it's like, oh God, here we go again.
I suddenly have the urge to create content on YouTube that just like subliminals of eat more sugar. Go grab the sugar bag and sit in front of the TV.
As
and
if my kids needed the additional
Do you see a
help?
Soda that looks like one of these three brands? Just try it.
Drink two.
All the bad things. Oh, on YouTube, too, the other quick shout-out I'll throw out is a guy named Philip Buck, B-U-U-C-K, and he's doing something called Handmade Quake, where he's taking the original Quake engine files that you can obtain from many places, and it's all open-sourced now, so you can actually download and do it. But he showed how to put it together and compile it and then run it, but now his series is switched over to actually going through the code. So one, if you have any interest at all in terms of how software is packaged to run on specific platforms, that, and if you like the Quake engine in gaming, I found that part fascinating, just to get an idea for what files to keep, what to get rid of, to simplify it down for running, in this case, a Windows environment. The next part, though, going into actual the coding of the files and the game itself, is something I've just started to scratch, and it's, I guess, version 2.0, and but do a Google search for Handmade Quake. I'll throw a link to that as well. And if you're into coding or just intro, getting your feet wet, the guy's got a good setup. Basically, you're just looking at the desktop as he works. And all of the stuff he's using is free to use,
nice.
Which is great. And the code is available for cheap or no cost as well. So it's kind of fun to just sit there at your workstation following along and actually getting it to run and getting a feel for how stuff works under the hood, so to speak. And it's using a piece of software that's near and dear to my heart. So I am all about the Quake and the Quake 2 and the Quake world. And that's all. That was a big part of my life.
It's still a shockingly compelling game.
Big part of my life back in the day.
Oh, my goodness. I hadn't realized until I was looking at the new Blu-ray releases for this week that the Criterion did a release of Gilda, which is a classic 1946 film with Rita Hayworth. If you studied film, you probably watched this at one point. But it's a beautiful, beautiful film, compelling story. And my understanding is from looking at the Blu-ray.com review is they used UCLA's Film and Television Archive that did a 2K restoration of Gilda, which means it probably looks better than it has in decades, which is pretty exciting. Straight Outta Compton hit Blu-ray this week. You know, the Inside Llewyn Davis Blu-ray hit the Criterion Collection this week. You know, a whole bunch of other, you know, it's kind of interesting watching more and more documentaries start to show up, although it seems like some weeks there's more, some weeks there's less. Gosh, new version of Mice's Men and the Ice Pirates.
No way.
Yep, Ice like Pirates is on Blu-ray.
The 90s or is that the 80s?
No, 1984, man.
Oh, do you have any ice? Was that the one that had the fight sequence while time was accelerating and everyone's probably hair got really big and it was hilarious. Anyway.
Yeah, that's one of the stranger movies from our youth to show up in a long time. But
juxtapose that kind of with the recent discoveries of water all over our solar system, and now it makes that a little funnier in a sense. But
well, it was 1984. Nobody knew any better.
We were so innocent then.
Oh my goodness! I'm still obsessed with Jennifer Jones. I'm working my way through that. It's the Marvel series that Netflix put together, and I bought a new Blu-ray player and discovered that I think my AVR may be failing. HDMI jacks in the back of my AVR.
Oh, that, you know what? That is a common failure point. I don't care how old it might be. Go check with the manufacturer for warranty fixes or stuff they were forced to do through class action.
It's funny because it may be that. And then I should say at first I thought it was issues with the HDMI connectors. Then I realized that it seemed to be more of an issue with HDCP glitching.
Handshaking.
Yeah.
From hell.
Well, handshaking into an incredible sort of white noise screen instead of the actual video. Because taking like an Apple TV or a Roku box and putting it on the same, you know, it's like, I'll swap. Oh, wow.
Cable's probably fine.
The cable seems, you know, it glitches, like basically the port glitches out on a Blu-ray player, but it doesn't glitch out on an Apple TV.
And if you haven't ran the software update on the player, it might be worth doing that.
Yeah, except that I was getting the same error a 7-year-old, 5-year-old Blu-ray player, or a Blu-ray player with like a 7-year-old manufacturing date and a Blu-ray player from, you know, approximately a month ago.
So I think you're on the right track, though. It very well may be the AVR, because of problems I've had with AVRs, built-in HDMI switching has always been one of them that can, and probably if something's going to fail, it's likely that.
Well, it's funny because, you know, on one hand, from an audio perspective, there's not a lot of compelling reasons to upgrade an AVR unless you're starting to get serious about Dolby Atmos or DTS:X, and I have no idea how I would even begin to deal with integrating Dolby Atmos in my current system unless I bought like a pair of third party Atmos speakers to bounce off my ceiling, right? Because right now I'm running these.
Can you get into your attic?
Yeah,
it's just to get the wire up there.
No, it's not a wiring. It's less of a wiring issue. I mean, I would not want to pull cable through my attic, although I can and will because I'll do things to get the sound. But it's more of an issue with having an amazing set of KEF T300 speakers, and I would prefer that the sonic signature was matched. But it'll be interesting. I may have a new AVR by next week just because I'm going to be able to watch my Blu-rays without emotional trauma.
You deserve a step up. Get something with all binding posts on the back too. Now that you've gone banana plug crazy.
I'm going straight to the wire cutters. Recommended AVR for $400.
That's probably a solid pick.
Well, yeah, it's not like I'm going to upgrade to 7.1 anytime soon because I'm not feeling the need.
I ended up with a 7.2 or whatever, right, just because that was the lowest end model.
You add a second subwoofer and a second the 6th and 7th speaker?
No.
Those additional rear surround channels?
None of that. I would like to get a second sub, budget permitting. I wouldn't mind that at all. But it was the lowest end model that had all binding posts and not the little spring loaded tabs. So that was the thing that drove my decision making there. The interconnects on the back. and then having just the number of HDMI ports I wanted for the switching of all good things. So,
oh my goodness.
I mean, that's the primary point of having an AVR too, is one, you're improving your audio quality dramatically with going from, you know, even a soundbar or are some great soundbars out there. Don't get me wrong, but going from TV speakers to a surround sound system, but having the automated side of it where, oh, you just plug everything into this AVR.
Yeah.
It'll decode whatever audio is coming out of that and give you the full quality, and it'll take care of all your switching needs for video. And it lets you just send one cable then out to the display.
Right.
Or in some cases, you can do two displays, like a projector and a TV, depending on which one you're using. Or that's, you know, just makes life easy.
Yeah. You know, for the most part, 5.1 is good enough for now. At some point, I might upgrade to 7.1. But so much of the experience, I think, is encompassed in 7.1. And mounting those last two speakers is going to be a considerable challenge. In my environment.
Well, I want to say for the THX recommended setup, they put the seven channels, the extra two out of a 5.1, right, on the back wall up high. All right, so kind of left and right facing, kind of aimed at you, but on the back wall compared to left and right sides of you that the rear surrounds are.
Well,
so there's a couple of ways to do it.
I don't think maybe it's less of a physical challenge and more of an aesthetic challenge.
Yeah.
Even I occasionally hit the wall on putting additional speakers in the house. Yeah, it was funny. You know, it was funny when I finally came to terms with the fact that, you know, the 5.1 rear speakers really are supposed to be aimed to the left and right of your head, not sitting behind you, which, you know, pretty much got fixed the first time I got on the Dolby surround sound speaker setup guide, which, by the way, if you've never been there, it is fantastic. Just search for Dolby speaker setup, and they do everything from 5.1 to 7.1 to 9.1 setups. And if you've never talked about 9.1, that's the additional front height channels to go along with the additional rear reinforcement
now,
channels in a 7.1 speaker system.
While I haven't stepped up to 7.1 in the same room, I do use the additional amplification channels for second room audio. Like, I want to put stereo in the room next door,
right,
or whatever. That's where you can have a lot of fun with that. And some of the higher, it seems like the higher up the food chain you go, if you wanted to do completely independent audio and video to a second room, you can do that as well. Mm-hmm. That will cost you a little bit more, but keep that in mind too. And good golly, if you're doing any kind of renovation or where you have the walls exposed type of upgrade to a room or a home where you will consider doing any kind of home theater, just get some of the speaker wire we've mentioned today and just put that in the walls and leave it there if nothing else.
Yeah.
Because that's the hardest part. I mean, installing an in-ceiling speaker, as long as you're going through just a standard piece of drywall next to a stud, that part's not so difficult, other than finding, you know, picking out the speaker you want. But the wiring side of it, that's where you can that's where it's nice to have kids around that can put on the respirator and go up into the attic and crawl into those tidy. Come here, kid. I've got a use for you.
Remember, if it's your children, it's not a child labor issue.
I did say a respirator, at least. So
that's very kind of you.
I'll
remember that as I'm dragging my unconscious children out of the...
Give them the headlamp and the respirator.
Our 34 insulation
just
in the
tie attic. Put a carabiner on the back of them with a little rope. You can pull them out in case they stop responding. And
I got to say, I mean, having heard a lot of demos, not a lot, but several demos in some of these amazing rooms inside of Dolby Labs, you know, as I'm not hugely compelled by 7.1 or 9.1, but I will say Atmos, especially with a movie like Gravity, is pretty spectacular. And of course the demos that they put together make it sound pretty amazing, but Atmos is really tempting. I don't know. We'll see. We need more titles. I hate to be early adopters on home theater, certain home theater technologies. And I also want to give a shout out before I go to AudioQuest. They sent me a pair of their Nighthawk headphones to demo, which are pretty spectacular. You know, AudioQuest makes cables and they may be gnashing their teeth at my attitude towards expensive cables, which is certainly the right. But I will say AudioQuest Dragonfly DAC is a pretty badass piece of technology. I got their 1.2 a year or two ago. And if you're looking for if you've got a decent set of headphones, you're looking for significant improvements on on the audio output from your laptop, your PC. It is a very nice piece of hardware. And I don't know if we talked about that. They came out with a couple of new DACs they announced at CES. Basically, the Red, which offers more voltage for headphones that high impedance headphones or headphones that need more amperage to run. Amperage is not the right word. I should say voltage. I'll get slagged on that, and rightfully. And the Jitterbug, which is a Blu-ray DAC. And I used to hate Blu-ray audio, but it's gotten really good in the last couple of years, and I'm really curious to hear that. But those Nighthawk headphones, they made some very distinctive decisions, and from a pure engineering standpoint, I look at them a lot in the same way I would look at a race car, in that they just made a lot of small things working very, very hard to maximize the opportunity for great audio. But I'll talk about those more in a future episode.
I use a Beck Blu-ray audio disc for doing listening tests and things like that. And that particular disc, I'm sure a lot of them are authored that way, but they're not cheap. They're like $25 to $30 per title. And the quality, though, the bit rate on like raw PCM coming out of that system is hitting the limit of the Blu-ray format. It's like 26, 27 megabit just for audio. And then it also, the same disc had compressed lossless formats too, which were a little easier to deal with. But still, that is just a fire hose of audible information. And the quality is just, if that's how it sounds in the studio in terms of how they put it together, I wouldn't doubt it. It's about as close to pristine as anything I've ever heard. I mean, even over CDs or anything. I'm just like, even albums. My roommate just bought a turntable, and he's starting to buy these albums now, and I'm like,
I don't know.
I those were my first experiences. I mean, 8-track tapes and albums were my first like audio things to listen to,
which is why I love CDs so much.
I was
digital audio.
I could never keep an album without scratching it somehow somewhere. And I don't miss that at all. I love having everything backed up on secure storage and digital.
Part of me wants to be like, oh, vinyl, 182 gram audiophile grade collector pressings. It's going to sound so much better than CDs. But man, even if I'm listening to something like Coltrane, I'm still not feeling that analog oomph I'm supposed to feel from vinyl. So maybe I'm a digital guy. I'm 21st century, man.
I am too. I am.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is probably the longest episode of AVXL we've dropped. Do us a favor. If it was too long, email us, ask@avxl.com, or yell at us on Twitter, @AVXL, @Patrick Norton, @Robert Heron, and let us know. Should we keep it to 30 minutes? Should we just talk until we are exhausted? We want your questions. We want your ideas. We want to hear what you are curious about, because there are a lot more of you than you are. There are of us, and you can help us make the show what you want it to be. And do us a favor, help us keep making the show. Go to patreon.com/AVXL and become a patron. And we're going to work on some other options to keep the show coming to you, because we like food and we like paying rent, because, you know, my communistic tendencies towards a free and open internet aside, I am a capitalist. And hey, so is this show.
Hey, my landlord likes the check.
He does. Oh my goodness. Hey everybody, thank you so much for listening.
Indeed.
I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Robert Heron.
We'll see you next week on AVXL.